made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we take a look at the American Mafia. Our guest is Thomas Repetto, a former commander of detectives in Chicago. He is the president of the New York City Citizens Crime Commission. He's also the author of American Mafia, A History of Its Rise to Power. The book looks at the American Mafia from the 1880s to the 1950s. Repetto says looking at this story, the story of the mafia in the U.S., offers us a way to look at, quote, the workings of political, governmental, bureaucratic, and economic forces in America in the first half of the 20th century. It serves as a window through which we can glimpse political and economic life in the U.S. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Thomas Repetto has served as the president of the New York City Citizens Crime Commission for 20 years. In addition to American Mafia, he is the author of NYPD, A City and Its Police. American Mafia, A History of Its Rise to Power is published by Henry Holt. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Thomas Repetto, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Good afternoon.
When did you begin to think about the rise of the American Mafia as more than a crime story, but as a way to look at the larger American society?
Well, I'm interested in organizations. We wrote a book about the NYPD. I've written books about American policing. I've written books about crime. Just as some people write about General Electric or the New York Yankees, I decided to write about what I call the American Mafia, which I think I should say at the outset is not the same thing or an extension of the Sicilian Mafia, although for a long time many people thought that was true, nor was American organized crime invented by immigrants who came at the turn of the century. They found it flourishing here already. But mafia has become such a popular term for organized crime, and there is almost no other one, that I call my book American Mafia because I'm looking at American organized crime.
Yeah, and it really, it took what it found here. I mean, it rose up from American soil, on the American soil. At the outset of the book, you mentioned J. Edgar Hoover. This was very interesting to me. Hoover said Italian-dominated gangs were a local problem, but this, you say, was disingenuous. Why didn't Hoover want to see the Bureau on the heels of the Mafia?
Well, when Hoover first took over the Bureau, it was a very small, largely unknown organization. And to get involved in attacking what I call the American Mafia, let's say, for example, the Capone organization in Chicago, would have brought them into prohibition law. It would have brought them into conflict with political figures, some of them very high. It is very clear that the mayor of Chicago or the governor of Illinois back in the 1920s had more than a passing acquaintanceship with the organization that Johnny Torrio and Al Capone ran. And so he decided that that would not be good for his bureau. The bureau had been created because the United States Secret Service, early in the century, conducted investigations for all federal agencies, and they sent a United States senator to prison for land fraud out in the West, whereupon their jurisdiction was severely curtailed. And President Theodore Roosevelt had to create by executive order another agency, which became the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So Hoover had that example before him. He also had the example of prohibition, in which the Prohibition Bureau itself was shot through with corruption and inefficiency. So he decided to stay out of that particular field. The question, of course, is why did he want to stay out after his bureau became so strong. Mm-hmm. That's not entirely clear.
Mm. I'm sure some listeners are thinking, though, at this moment, didn't the FBI go after the number one public enemies, you know, that were endangering us at the time?
Well, those were people like John Dillinger, Ma Barker, Pretty Boy Floyd. They were not really members of organized crime. They were bank robbers and killers. And yes, the FBI brought them down. But Capone, for example, was brought down by agents of the United States Treasury for tax violations. Luciano, who was the big figure in New York in the 1930s, the premier organized crime person, was brought down by the district attorney of New York County, Tom Dewey, who later became the governor and twice ran for president of the United States. So the FBI did not have much success against organized crime. Now, Hoover always said they didn't have any jurisdiction in that area. They didn't enforce the tax laws, but there were other possibilities. They certainly enforced laws against interstate prostitution, and Capone was mixed up in that area, at least indirectly. So there were possibilities for moving against the mob.
Yeah. Al Capone, very interesting to realize that he really, what you say, he was an example of what not to do as a gang leader. And his heyday was pretty short-lived. What were his faults?
Well, he took over in the mid-20s after his boss, Johnny Torrio, was badly wounded and left Chicago. Torrio was really an organizational genius and was one of the creators of what became a national crime syndicate by the 1930s. Torrio went back east where he came from and continued to operate, but in a less public way. Capone was a very violent man. There was constant warfare going on in the streets of Chicago, people being killed, and it culminated in the massacre on Valentine's Day in 1929, in which 7 men were machine gunned to death in a garage on North Clark Street in Chicago. That brought so much pressure against Capone that he was summoned by mob bosses to a meeting in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Johnny Torrio presided over the meeting, and they persuaded Capone that he had created so much bad publicity for them that he'd better disappear. And so he went down to Philadelphia, was just upon arrival in the city, was arrested carrying a gun, and quickly pleaded guilty and was given a year in a Philadelphia jail along with his bodyguard. Most people feel that was kind of a setup to get him out of Chicago. And then he spent a good deal of time in Florida, and by that time the federal government, on orders of President Herbert Hoover, was after him for tax violations. But they were really after him because he was a bad symbol of the United States of America, of machine guns being fired in the streets, of massive corruption. And so the people who followed him in the mob world profited from that example and tried to keep a lower profile and to hold down the violence to the extent that they could.
Thomas Repetto is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of American Mafia, A History of Its Rise to Power. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Someone listening this afternoon on the Internet in California waiting to talk with us on line 4. Good afternoon.
Yes, hi. I'm always interested in this. I've read both of those books about J. Edgar Hoover. there were two of them that came out maybe going on 10 years ago. The big stories in them were that J. Edgar Hoover was dressing up like a woman, but one of the sections in both of the books, long passages, long chapters, talked about J. Edgar Hoover's taking two vacations per year. Each vacation was 6 weeks long. He would go down to Clint Murchison hotels, which were essentially organized crime hotels, and he would sit by the poolside with Meyer Lansky. And it was apparently a big game for all of the well-known mafia figures to have their photographs taken with him. I'm wondering, with this in mind, you've already mentioned that Hoover refused to admit that organized crime existed, and many people have said that he never cracked down on organized crime for virtually all of the 50 years he was in power. And I'm wondering, this has certainly allowed organized crime to get a head start in laundering their money in America. And I'm just wondering if the problems of that we have with corruption in Congress and corruption in the White House and whatnot is directly related to this. Does organized crime essentially run America now?
No, I don't think organized crime runs America. I think traditional organized crime, as it's called in law enforcement today, has less power than they had some years ago when they could name mayors and governors in certain cities and states. It's interesting about Hoover. Many, many stories have been written about Hoover. He liked to hang around a place called the Stork Club in New York City, which was a popular watering hole. Gangsters like Frank Costello were there. But nothing has really, no smoking gun has turned up to my knowledge. Hoover was feuding with some elements of the New York City Police Department back in the 1950s. And the doorman at the Stork Club, it's reported, was an ex-cop, and he kept an eye on Hoover and informed the New York City police about Hoover's movements. And nothing ever turned up. So while he was reluctant to move against organized crime, finally did move after the Appalachian Conference in 1957, we're not sure what his relationship was with some of these individuals. No one has produced any evidence about personal corruption.
Well, have you read these two different books?
I've read a number of books on. There are many, many books have been written on J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI.
Well, they're very clear about sitting with Meyer Lansky, usually for 2 weeks of each of the vacations, 2 6-week vacations per year, and then twice a year he would sit by the poolside with Meyer Lansky for essentially a full month of the year. And realizing that Meyer Lansky was the money launderer for all of the different families, it becomes kind of a specious argument to think that J. Edgar Hoover was solely being blackmailed by organized crime, when in fact, for example, organized crime ran most of the gay clubs throughout the world, or the America. And, you know, it set the gays, of course, up to being blackmailed, but at the same time, it was their field. You know, 15% of the population is gay, and then 15% of organized crime was gay, too. So the idea that J. Edgar Hoover was being blackmailed doesn't really wash. It seems more likely that Hoover was there to facilitate the money laundering.
I don't think that he was being blackmailed, but people have reported he would go to the racetrack and get tips on horses from Walter Winchell, and it was generally thought that Walter Winchell was getting his tips from Frank Costello. But as I say, I have not seen the evidence, particularly around New York here, of any blackmail or bribery, if you will, to J. Edgar Hoover. I think he decided to keep his bureau out for reasons I mentioned, but after 1957, of course, they began to be fairly active in that area, and particularly when Robert Kennedy was Attorney General.
Yeah, I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. You know, the mafia, of course, has been a favorite subject for Hollywood and the news media. How accurate or inaccurate have the stories been, fictional and the ones that appear on the front pages of the newspapers?
I'm afraid largely inaccurate. Much time was spent trying to connect American organized crime to foreign secret societies. The mafia is a term correctly applied to certain bands of criminals in the western portion of the island of Sicily. And while there were always some relationships between people in the United States and people overseas, particularly later in drug smuggling, it would be a mistake to presume that the American organized crime groups were controlled from abroad. But you often saw that. There were always searches for mysterious Mr. Biggs, who were supposed to control everything behind the scenes, when I think it was much more open than that. So, yes, I think a lot of what has been portrayed about organized crime is somewhat inaccurate.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's a very colorful subject. Chicago in the 1920s has passed into our national folklore as a time of glamour, as a time that many people, even though they didn't live then, think they know very well.
Yeah. It's interesting that the misconceptions about the mafia in this country go all the way back to the 19th century.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And different terms were applied mafia, Black Hand. There was confusion between the mafia and the Black Hand. The Black Hand was simply a method of extorting money by sending notes, sometimes with a Black Hand on them. And it was argued that the mafia and the Black Hand were synonymous and that they were connected with alien groups, which was not correct.
Mm. We've got another listener waiting to talk with us. A listener in Farmer City, line 4. Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. Well, you mentioned Hollywood and you mentioned other gangs. I was wondering if you might do a little movie review on the Gangs of New York. The point of that movie, all I could figure out from it, was that the extent to which gangs and politics were intertwined in New York on Manhattan and were a major force in the history of New York. Is that the point, and is that true?
Yeah, the gangs at the time portrayed, which was before the Civil War, while there are certain inaccuracies in the movie, certain license taken, the gangs of the Five Points and the Bowery were sluggers for Tammany Hall. They were a very important part of the Tammany political machine, which was the center of organized crime in New York then and later on. The boss was a Mississippi riverboat gambler named Ike Rinders, who controlled the gangs and was a very powerful figure in Tammany Hall. So that's, to that extent, it is quite correct.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call. 333-945-5800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Thomas Repetto, our guest this afternoon. He's the author of American Mafia, A History of Its Rise to Power. You open the book in New Orleans, and as you describe it, one tough city. Tell us a little bit about what life was like in New Orleans in the late 19th century, and maybe you'd tell us about one of the city's chiefs of police, Dave Hennessy.
Yes, well, the murder of Chief Hennessy in 1890, supposedly by the mafia, that's the way it was portrayed to the United States, first brought to national attention some of these stories about Italian immigrants and organized crime. Hennessy was a New Orleans police officer. He was conducting an investigation of one gang that was feuding with another gang on the New Orleans waterfront. There had been some shooting incidents when he himself was murdered. He had a checkered career on the New Orleans Police Department. He, as a detective, he and his cousin, who was also a detective, had shot their chief of detectives, and then they had to go off the force for a while. He came back. A number of people were arrested, Italians who were living in New Orleans, and brought to trial, some of them. And the jury acquitted some and could not agree on others, whereupon a lynch mob was quickly formed and took the prisoners out of jail and lynched them, shot them, hung them from lampposts. The Italian government became so upset about it that diplomatic relations were broken off between the United States and Italy, and there was even fear that the Italian fleet, which at that time was larger than the American, was going to bombard our East Coast cities. Eventually, the United States government paid a settlement to some of the lynching victims' families. But the word spread all over the United States that this secret society, quote-unquote, had murdered the chief of police of New Orleans and was engaged in all kinds of depredations. Well, there was a lot going on in New Orleans. It had been an occupied city during the Civil War. There was a great deal of crime and vice. Periodically, New Orleans has figured in the news as one of America's most colorful cities, I'll put it that way.
Checkered?
Yes, but they're not the only ones.
Right.
There are others. So that was really the first introduction, the first time most Americans heard about this phenomenon called the mafia.
Yeah. The reaction of local authorities there in New Orleans to the gunning down of these defendants after six of them were acquitted and the jury couldn't bring a verdict on the other three. Tell us about the reaction of local authorities to the situation.
Well, they didn't do much. Some of them made themselves very scarce when the lynch mob was gathering The mayor and the governor were nowhere to be found. There was an Italian consul there, a diplomatic representative of the Italian government, who begged the authorities to do something to stop the mob, but he was unsuccessful. After the lynching, he telegraphed to his superiors in Washington, saying he was personally in great danger, but the situation, nothing ever happened to the people involved in the mob. I think most people in New Orleans applauded their editorials around the United States in respectable newspapers, saying that, well, while it's deplorable, it's not very deplorable.
Yeah. And Italian-on-Italian crime was also something that was not to be bothered with, and so therefore not to be paid attention to. And
There was a famous chief of detectives here in New York, which a co-author and I wrote about in NYPD, named Thomas Burns. He was the first great American police officer, founded the Modern Detective Bureau. And he was baffled by a murder involving some Italians. He promised that he would solve it. When the defendant that he charged was acquitted, he said, well, I washed my hands and let them kill each other.
Yeah. But there were officers of the law who tried to make a difference, who were interested in fighting the crimes of Italian gangs.
The first great one was Lieutenant Joseph Petrosino, who himself came to the United States from southern Italy as a young boy. He joined the police department here in New York, had fabulous success as a detective. There were also mystery stories written about him in Italy, as referring to him as the Italian Sherlock Holmes. Very hardworking, dedicated individual. There's a park, a little park down here in Lower Manhattan that is named for him, and there is a reason it is named for him. In 1909, the police commissioner decided to send him to Sicily to investigate the background of American immigrants to see if some of them had lied about having criminal records, which meant they could be deported, and to check up on people wanted by the NYPD. Now, that was not a very sensible move, to send this police lieutenant into the heart of the real mafia country, and he was assassinated in Palermo, Sicily. To date, he is the only New York City police officer slain in the line of duty outside the country, and there is a park named for him. He was also the first head of the bomb squad of the New York City Police Department. He was very active in investigating what were called black hand bombings. And he was a fabulous police officer and is still remembered by the New York City Police Department today.
Yeah. Also another law enforcement officer, member of the police department in New York City, that seems to be quite an interesting character, although he was eventually forced out, pressured out, Big Mike Fischetti. Yeah.
Yes, he went. 12 years after Petrosino's fatal trip, acting Captain Fischetti was commanding the same squad that Petrosino had commanded, and they decided to send him over to Naples to conduct some investigations. And he had a number of adventures there, and as he relates, barely escaped with his life. Now, he did leave the police department in the early 1920s, but I'm happy to report that after Fiorello LaGuardia became the mayor in the early 1930s, he called Fischetti back to city service and made him a deputy commissioner in an agency that investigated industrial racketeering. So Fischetti, in effect, was rewarded for his career.
Yeah, and there's another Italian-American hero in the story you just mentioned, LaGuardia.
Yes, Fiorello LaGuardia was the son of an Italian father and a Jewish mother. He considered his home to be Prescott, Arizona, because his father was bandmaster of an American infantry regiment stationed there. And all his life, LaGuardia would wear a big 10-gallon hat and talk like a Western cowboy. He was deeply patriotic. He was a pilot in World War I. He was a staunch foe of crime of all sorts. Very pugnacious fellow, and during the 12 years that he was the mayor of New York, he made it pretty tough for a lot of gangsters.
Yeah. Well, back to law enforcement folks, Elliot Ness, way overrated, according to you.
Well, Elliot Ness was a very good law enforcement officer, very honest, very hardworking, but the story of Elliot Ness that's portrayed on the screen has really no resemblance to reality. Ness was a prohibition agent. Most of the work against Capone was done by tax agents, from the Treasury Department, but Ness and his squad did make a lot of raids. However, raids were common. Everybody was making raids on places that were selling illegal liquor or manufacturing illegal liquor. Later on, in the 1950s, Ness told his story to a reporter who, as happens in those kind of stories, made it somewhat dramatic. Ness was out there raiding places in Chicago, and certainly that was a dangerous job. He really did a tremendous job later on when he was director of public safety of Cleveland, Ohio. He was in charge of the police and fire department in what was then, I think, the fifth or sixth largest city in the United States. And he cleaned up police corruption, and he was a very, very effective law enforcement officer, a very popular man in the city, so popular that that after the war he ran for mayor of Cleveland, although he didn't do well in the election. But then his life went on a somewhat downward spiral. So the story of the Untouchables, while some color was added to it, the book was basically correct, but the television version took many liberties and invented incidents that never occurred. And, of course, in the movie, let's just say that that's an interesting movie, Ness did not kill Frank Nitti. Frank Nitti went on living a long time after Nitti killed himself in the 1940s. But, you know, when people are making movies or television shows, they do take dramatic license.
Yeah. Print the legend, as you title the chapter in the book. Let's talk with another listener, caller on line one, on the campus of the U of I. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. Can I ask you, is your guest of Italian instruction?
Yes, my father was.
Okay. I was just curious. Two things.
Why do you ask?
Well, to me, it gives it a little more believability. But anyway,
I don't claim expertise on Italian culture. I claim some expertise in the area of law enforcement. But as I point out, the organized crime in America and what we call the American Mafia was never exclusively Italian, although there were some there and some of the big bosses were. But I also point out, we've mentioned a few here, a number of law enforcement officers who were of Italian extraction and fought very hard against organized crime. But go ahead, I just was curious.
Well, I myself am Latino, and I admire a lot of Italian things. But anyway, I was going to ask you, maybe I should tell you first that my wife is getting really loves the Soprano series.
Many people do.
Yeah.
Doing very well.
She's a library type, and so it's kind of funny to see her, you know, getting into it. But anyway, I wanted to ask you: what's the history of the mafia in terms of what used to be like girly clubs and exotic dancers, and now gentlemen's clubs? Are they still into it?
Oh yes, oh yes. We've had some of them here in New York that went to jail for their involvement in those operations, not for running the clubs, but for cheating on taxes and that sort of thing. Organized crime is going to be in operations that are, well, they're going to be wherever money can be made, let's put it that way. And clubs give you an excellent chance to skim money. That's one of the reasons people want to be in nightclubs. It's a chance to launder money. It's a chance to skim money. They're fun to run. Nightclubs were kept alive in one era in America by mob money. During the Depression, there was no money around. If it wasn't for the gangsters in New York, they bankrolled most of the clubs, and I mean the ones that society people went to.
And well, I know when I was a kid and I frequented such clubs, I never got the impression that there was anything really dark behind them. But that was here in the Midwest. And
sometimes those places were very well run. There were places in New York. It's generally believed Costello put up the money for the Stork Club, and that was a place where the top stars of Hollywood and top society people in the gathered, and there were many other places in New York, and those kind of clubs were very exclusive. They were very well run. Some ordinary person like myself would never get past the head waiter.
Yeah, me neither. Can I ask you, Tony Soprano's into waste management, as he puts it. What's the history there?
Quite a bit of involvement, at least in this part of the country. Quite a bit of involvement. There have been some very major prosecutions here over the last years in the New York region for organized crime infiltration in that area.
Yeah. Where does
what's the attraction there? Because wouldn't it be more difficult for them to skim money there and launder
well,
money?
Well, they carved up territories. Muscle was used. If you wanted to get into that business on your own, you would be told that you would be discouraged from doing that. And you might then want to pay somebody off, and you would be given a territory, and you better not move into somebody else's territory. We've had some murders here of people who, out on Long Island, who were fighting with organized crime, legitimate contractors who were fighting with organized crime. So certainly that's been a big area here.
Yeah, and also in that business, waste management, there's the demand is not elastic. It's inelastic. You got to have it, so it's always going to be there, right?
Right.
Let's talk with another listener. I want to thank the caller on the campus for his call this afternoon. Next, we go to a listener in Cerro Gordo, line 4. Hi.
Hello. I had a question specifically about the numbers racket. When I was a kid, I had it explained to me why a man got hurt real bad because he was taking too much off the top, and it was bad for business. I was wondering, I've at least always been under the impression that the mob took an awful lot smaller cut than the government does. Could you give your highlights on that one, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, if it was run correctly, for example, if you bought a number, the odds would be like, theoretically, the odds were 999-1 that it would come up. They paid off at 600-1, so certainly there was some money there for the people running the wheel, but on many occasions, those wheel drawings were rigged. It's interesting that the Italian lottery, the lottery in Italy, was extremely honestly run, the government lottery in Italy, and there was a phrase, it's as honest as the lottery, that people had absolute confidence in that lottery. Now, some folks here in America decided to rig the numbers. They changed the numbers from what the winning drawings were in Italy and cheated people. When that happened, out came the guns. But there's always going to be some cheating. There's going to be some skimming. Those are endemic in that type of operation.
Yeah. In my introduction earlier this hour, I mentioned that this book, American Mafia, your book, is a way in which we can take a look at the political and economic life of the United States. And I want to go back now to Chicago and talk about a guy, Diamond Jim. He went from bootblack to pimp to host to the elite. That's a rags-to-riches story, isn't it?
Yes. He was a much-loved man in the last decade or so of his life. He ran a very large restaurant cabaret in Chicago, and yes, he had been vice lord of the Levee District on the south side of Chicago before World War I, but he had many, many friends in the elite who came to his restaurant who liked him personally, and when he was murdered in 1920, a number of very prominent Chicagoans went to the funeral, despite the fact that they were warned it would not be appropriate. In fact, editorials were written in the Chicago paper saying, how could captains of industry and leading businessmen and come to the funeral of this man who was the vice lord of the city? But as one reporter wrote, people said, I don't care what he was, he was my friend, and I'm going to the funeral.
An enterprising individual, Johnny Torrio also. And these men changed as the times changed.
Torrio was a very different personality. Jim Calasimo was a big, burly, outgoing fellow. As I point out in the book, his trouble started when he fell in love with a beautiful young singer and married her, and that was not looked upon with favor, partly because he was creating problem with his wife, divorcing his wife, and partly because he was neglecting his business, and so his death followed. Johnny Torrio, who many people believe, who was Jim's lieutenant, and many people believe ordered the murder of Jim, because Jim was neglecting business, was a very different individual. He was a quiet, introverted person. He liked to go home at night and put on opera records and sit listening to them with his eyes closed and tried to avoid violence as much as possible. He wasn't loved in the way that Jim Colosimo was, and Al Capone, who was the next man in charge there, was not loved at all by most people.
Well, let's talk with some other callers here. Next, we're going to go to a listener in Spring Bay, Line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I used to live on the Upper East Side, Manhattan, and there was a Italian, we all thought it was a mafia club, called the Victory Star Club. Ever heard of that?
No, I did not.
East 76th. Anyway, between 2nd and 3rd. Anyway, I was standing on the street one day, and this guy came walking down the street. He had a newspaper rolled up under his arm, and he just kind of had a little gimpy walk, and I was watching him. He walked past the club, and these guys are sitting out in front, and he dropped the newspaper in a guy's lap. Didn't miss a step, kept on walking. This was in the days of OTB already. What was he doing? Was there a numbers racket or something?
Could be some number slips in there, some gambling slips of some kind.
Okay, well, I just, I bought, you know, fell over when I saw it. I was like, could figure out what they were
doing. That's a pretty high-rent area here in New York.
What's that?
The area you described is a very high-rent neighborhood.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, it was one of these little storefront men's clubs, and that was a very quiet street that we lived on. You know, there was no problems, and it was all right. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay. Sounds like something right out of the movies, doesn't it?
Oh, yes.
Drop the paper in somebody's lap and walk away. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line one in Charleston. Good afternoon.
Yes. I wonder if your guest might acknowledge that the mafia and those sorts of activities that are deemed criminal is only a microcosm of capitalism at large, with all of its warts, violence, and bump-offs, and the whole thing. It occurs to me that it is that. You know, the criminality attached to it, you know, then gives it this dark aura, whereas legitimate capitalism have other means to execute life and to their profit. And I wondered if he saw or understands any parallels between the two.
Well, I'm not sure the argument you're making, or that I would agree, but that organized crime was heavily involved in the economic system and reflects the economic system is certainly true. Now, in the book, I describe how the mobs almost took over Hollywood. As one of them said, we had 20% and we were on the way to 50%. And they had been invited in to some extent by the top movie moguls. And the moguls themselves, when the mobsters went down, some of the moguls, at least one of them, went to jail for tax evasion. It's interesting. I think I should say, I was fortunate enough during the research for the book to meet the assistant United States attorney who prosecuted the Hollywood extortion case and sent the whole top level of the Chicago mob to prison. That case was in 1943. This gentleman's name is Boris Castellanets. He's 91 years old, and he still is the name partner in a major New York law firm practicing law every day. And that was a tremendous break for me to meet him and get the inside story of the Hollywood extortion case.
Mm. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. How was the mob able to really be so successful there for a number of years in Hollywood?
They got into the middle of the labor management struggles. The moguls needed them to keep the labor force in line, and then they organized the labor force and began shaking down. Started out in Chicago, and it's a kind of a complicated story, but it involved New York, Chicago, and Hollywood. They were able to guarantee labor peace for a price.
Hmm.
But then the price became very high. The price was about 20% of Hollywood, and it was going to go up to about 50% of Hollywood. They would have been running the movie industry, and the economic term countervailing power appeared in the person of the federal government, of the United States government. And there was a big prosecution, and all the top echelon of the Chicago mob was sent to prison, except for Nitti, who committed suicide. He didn't want to stand trial.
Hmm. Let's talk with one more listener this afternoon before we wrap things up. A caller in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Hi. Did you find any connections between the Chicago gangs and the gangs in southern Illinois and Williamson County, Berger and Shelton?
Berger and Shelton. Not many people know those stories. They were sort of a world of their own, and I don't know that anybody would believe about the war that was carried on with tanks and bombs dropped from airplanes. I think people in Chicago used to kind of shake their head at the at how rough it was down there in the 1920s. And as you know, there was an aftermath of that war for a long time, on into the 50s, I think even into the 60s. But they would be a book in themselves.
Well, maybe that should be your next one.
No, I think somebody around the university there ought to look into that.
Somebody here in Illinois.
Yes.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, to wrap up here this afternoon, where does the mafia's power remain today? And, you know, the heyday was probably 30s, 40s, 50s, but today it's a different story.
Yes, they're still around. They're still in some of the traditional areas, but there are also other groups out there. One of the favorite pastimes among law enforcement is to say which group will become the preeminent organized crime group in the United States, and everybody has their sponsors. I think you'll see a melding, and if I were to predict an area where there would be even greater growth, it would be in the financial services area.
Oh, swell.
I mean, there's already some of that, but I think that's the ability to move money now so quickly by pushing a few buttons on a computer is really gives a fantastic opportunity for lots of fraud.
Yeah. Well, there we'll leave it. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Pleasure.
Thomas Repetto has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's a former commander of detectives in Chicago. He's the president of the New York City Citizens Crime Commission. He's the author of American Mafia, A History of Its Rise to Power. In addition to American Mafia, he is the author of NYPD, A City and Its Police. The new book, American Mafia, published by Henry Holt. It's 11 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in now from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures finished the day a bit better than they did yesterday. The only real loser was in the wheat pit, and that's down anywhere between 4.5 and 5.5 cents for the day. Let's begin there. The March contract in the wheat, 390.5, the high, the low at 380. A settlement price at 380.5. They finished 4.5 lower. The May futures, 395.5, the high, the low at 386.25. A settlement there at 386.75. They finished down 4.75. July wheat now, 389, the high, the low at 380.5, settlement price at 381.5, down 5.5 cents, and the September 391, the high, low at 384.5, and a settlement price at 385, down 5.5. December futures for the wheat, 399, the high, the low at 393, a settlement price 394, they were down 5 cents. From the corn pit, anywhere between a penny and 3/4 and 2.5 higher for the day. The March contract did finish a penny and 3/4 higher at 273, had a high today of 275.75, the range down to 271.25 on the low, so only about 4 cents in there. May futures for the corn, 281 the high, the low at 276.25, a settlement price at 278, up 2, and July at 283 high, low at 278.5, settlement price at 280.5, up 2.25. September futures for the corn pit, 277.5 the high, the low at 273.5, and that September contract, 275.25, a penny and 3/4 higher. Now the new crop, December futures, corn, 273.75 the high, low at 269.75, settled 270.75, up 1.25, and the March corn, 276 3/4 high, low at 273 1/4. The March 05 corn settling two higher at 274 1/2. July futures for 05, 279 the high, the low at 276 1/4, settled 278 up 2.5 cents. And the December 05, this is 2 years out, 253 the high, the low at 250 1/2. That December 2005 crop, 253, a settlement price up 3 cents for the day. March oats, 158 the high, the low at 154, settlement at 156 up 1/4. May oat contract, a 160 1/4 high, low at 156 1/4, and a settlement price at 159. They finished 1/4 higher as well. From the soy complex, March soybeans, 805 1/2 the high, the low at 791 1/2. A settlement price at 802 1/2, managing to break through that $8 barrier on the settlement today, 9.5 cents higher. May futures, 807 1/2 high, low at 794 1/4, and they finished 804 1/2, up 8 3/4. July soybeans, a 798 1/2 high, low at 787 1/2, settlement price at 795. They finished up 6.5 cents. September, 715 high, low at 707, settled 712, up 4. And now the Novembers. This is the new crop, 646 1/2 high, low at 641, settled 644 3/4, up 1.5 cents. January soybeans, 648 the high, the low at 644, a settlement price at 645, up 0.5 cent. And the March 05 contract, 648 the high, the low at 646. March soybeans, a settlement price, 648. They finished 2 higher. March bean meal, 248.10 the high, the low at 243.60, and the March bean meal settled at 246.80, up 170. May futures, 248.50 high, low at 245, settled 246.90. They were up 20 for the day. March bean oil, 29.93 the high, the low at 29.02, and a settlement price at 29.86. They finished 88 higher in the May bean oil. 29.80 the high, low at 28.95, a settlement price at 29.72, and they finished up 78. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. A lower day today on the Mercantile Exchange, although February and March bellies finished higher. March feeder cattle, 84.35 the high, 83.67 1/2 the low, 83.72 1/2 the settlement, that down 32 1/2. April, 85.80 the high, 85.22 1/2 the low, 85.42 1/2 the settlement, that down 27 1/2. May, 86.20 the high, 85.60 the low, 85.85 the settlement, that down 32 1/2. August feeder cattle, 88.60 the high, 88.15 the low, 88.27 1/2 the settlement, that down 27 1/2. February live cattle, 76.82 1/2 the high, 75.82 1/2 the low, 76.32 1/2 the settlement, that down 20. March live cattle, 74.50 the high, 74.10 the low, 74.10 the settlement, that down 35. April, 73.30 the high, 72.50 the low, 72.87 1/2 the settlement, that down 27 1/2. June live cattle, 70.50 the high, 69.75 the low, 69.92 1/2 the settlement, that down 30. February lean hogs, 59.05 the high, 58.35 the low, 58.92 1/2 the settlement, that down 10. April 60.20 the high, 59.25 the low, 59.35 the settlement, that down 65. May lean hogs were unchanged today, 60.70 the high, 60.20 the low, 60.70 the settlement, unchanged. June 64.90 the high, 64.60 the low, 64.75 the settlement, that down 10. February pork bellies, 86.50 the high, 85.10 the low, 86.12 1/2 the settlement, that up 127 1/2. March pork bellies, 87.25 the high, 86.10 the low, the settlement, 86.72 1/2, that up 80. In just a moment, I'll have the latest on Wall Street, on the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
It's 5 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. A reminder, all Unit 7 schools, the Unity School District, are closing today at 2:05. Let's take a look now at what's happening on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 5 points at 10,494. The NASDAQ is down 3 at 2060. The S&P 500 is one lower at 1134.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Jeff Vieira from Misawa Air Base, Japan, wants to know, dear Dr. Science, who set the speed limit of light? Is it different in Montana?
Sure it is. Everything's different in Montana. Those people just don't think the way you and I do. If a Montanan wants to protest a parking ticket, he builds a bunker in a remote hillside, holes up there with a year's supply of crackers and water, and waits for someone to track him down. This sort of rugged individualism guarantees that in Montana, the speed of light is a matter of personal choice. Sometimes it's slower than the speed of sound. Sometimes it zips around like a Teflon-tipped bullet. Now, I've never actually been to Montana, but I hear that's what it's like. Real unpredictable.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. To order the Dr. Science Get Smart Kit with new CD, screensaver for PCs, and a master's degree mouse pad, $21.95, call 800-989-DUCK.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and coffee bar.
Illinois voters will nominate candidates for U.S. Senate on March 16th. Join us for live debates from Illinois Public Radio and the Daily Herald. Republicans meet Tuesday, February 3rd, and Democrats Wednesday, February 4th.
Both debates start at 6:30 p.m. Central Time on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
You're tuned to AM 580. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director today. Coming up at 2:06, the closing market report with Todd Gleason. That will be preceded by news from NPR. Let's take a look at the forecast for Illinois and Indiana from meteorologist Scott Althoff. This afternoon in Illinois, partly to mostly sunny. In Indiana, mostly cloudy with a few flurries. Highs this afternoon ranging from 13 in northwestern Illinois to 30 in the far south. Tonight, clear to partly cloudy. Lows ranging from 5 below zero in northwestern Illinois to 18 above in the far south. Tomorrow in northeastern Illinois and in northern and east central Indiana, mostly sunny. Elsewhere, increasing cloudiness. Highs ranging from 15 in far northwestern Illinois to 38 in the far south. In Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, becoming partly to mostly sunny. Temperatures holding steady in the middle teens. Winds westerly at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Wind chills around zero through the afternoon. Tonight, mostly clear and cold. The low